Law 46. Never appear too perfect. Judgment. Appearing better than others is always dangerous, but most dangerous of all is to appear to have no faults or weaknesses. Envy creates silent enemies. It is smart to occasionally display defects and admit to harmless vices in order to deflect envy and appear more human and approachable. Only gods and the dead can seem perfect with impunity. Transgression of the law. Joe Orton met Kenneth Halliwell at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, London, in 1953, where both had enrolled as acting students. They soon became lovers and moved in together. Halliwell, 25 at the time, was 7 years older than Orton and seemed the more confident of the two, but neither had much talent as actors, and after graduating, having settled down together in a dank London apartment, they decided to give up acting and collaborate as writers instead. Halliwell's inheritance was enough to keep them from having to find work for a few years, and in the beginning, he was also the driving force behind the stories and novels they wrote. He would dictate to Orton, who would type the manuscripts, occasionally interjecting his own lines and ideas. Their first efforts attracted some interest from literary agents, but it sputtered. The promise they had shown was leading nowhere. Eventually, the inheritance money ran out, and the pair had to look for work. Their collaborations were less enthusiastic and less frequent. The future looked bleak. In 1957, Orton began to write on his own, but it wasn't until 5 years later, when the lovers were jailed for 6 months for defacing dozens of library books, that he began to find his voice, perhaps not by chance. This was the first time he and Halliwell had been separated in 9 years. He came out of prison determined to express his contempt for English society in the form of theatrical farces. He and Halliwell moved back in together, but now the roles were reversed. Orton did the writing, while Halliwell put in comments and ideas. In 1964, Joe Orton completed his first full-length play, Entertaining Mr. Sloan. The play made it to London's West End, where it received brilliant reviews. A great new writer had emerged from nowhere. Now, success followed success at a dizzying pace. In 1966, Orton had a hit with his play, Loot, and his popularity soared. Soon, commissions came in from all sides, including from the Beatles, who paid Orton handsomely to write them a film script. Everything was pointing upwards, everything except Orton's relationship with Kenneth Halliwell. The pair still lived together, but as Orton grew successful, Halliwell began to deteriorate. Watching his lover become the center of attention, he suffered the humiliation of becoming a kind of personal assistant to the playwright, his role in what had once been a collaboration growing smaller and smaller. In the 1950s, he had supported Orton with his inheritance. Now Orton supported him. At a party or among friends, people would naturally gravitate towards Orton. He was charming, and his mood was almost always buoyant. Unlike the handsome Orton, Halliwell was bald and awkward. His defensiveness made people want to avoid him. With Orton's success, the couple's problems only worsened. Halliwell's moods made their life together impossible. Orton claimed to want to leave him and had numerous affairs, but would always end up returning to his old friend and lover. He tried to help Halliwell launch a career as an artist, even arranging for a gallery to show his work, but the show was a flop, and this only heightened Halliwell's sense of inferiority. In May of 1967, the pair went on a brief holiday together in Tangiers, Morocco. During the trip, Orton wrote in his diary, "We sat talking of how happy we felt, and how it couldn't surely last. We'd have to pay for it, or we'd be struck down from afar by disaster because we were, perhaps, too happy. To be young, good-looking, healthy, famous, comparatively rich, and happy is surely going against nature." Halliwell outwardly seemed as happy as Orton. Inwardly, though, he was seething. And 2 months later, in the early morning of August 10th, 1967, just days after helping Orton put the finishing touches to the wicked farce, What the Butler Saw, undoubtedly his masterpiece, Kenneth Halliwell bludgeoned Joe Orton to death with repeated blows of a hammer to the head. He then took 21 sleeping pills and died himself, leaving behind a note that read, "If you read Orton's diary, all will be explained." Interpretation. Kenneth Halliwell had tried to cast his deterioration as mental illness, but what Joe Orton's diaries revealed to him was the truth. It was envy, pure and simple, that lay at the heart of his sickness. The diaries, which Halliwell read on the sly, recounted the couple's days as equals and their struggle for recognition. After Orton found success, the diaries began to describe Halliwell's brooding, his rude comments at parties, his growing sense of inferiority. All of this, Orton narrated with a distance that bordered on contempt. The diaries made clear Halliwell's bitterness over Orton's success. Eventually, the only thing that would have satisfied him would have been for Orton to have a failure of his own, an unsuccessful play, perhaps, so that they could have commiserated in their failure as they had done years before. When the opposite happened, as Orton grew only more successful and popular, Halliwell did the only thing that would make them equals again. He made them equals in death. With Orton's murder, he became almost as famous as his friend, posthumously. Joe Orton only partly understood his lover's deterioration. His attempt to help Halliwell launch a career in art registered for what it was, charity and guilt. Orton basically had two possible solutions to the problem. He could have downplayed his own success, displaying some faults, deflecting Halliwell's envy, or, once he realized the nature of the problem, he could have fled as if Halliwell were a viper, as in fact he was, a viper of envy. Once envy eats away at someone, everything you do only makes it grow, and day by day it festers inside them. Eventually, they will attack. Only a minority can succeed at the game of life, and that minority inevitably arouses the envy of those around them. Once success happens your way, however, the people to fear the most are those in your own circle, the friends and acquaintances you have left behind. Feelings of inferiority gnaw at them. The thought of your success only heightens their feelings of stagnation. Envy, which the philosopher Kierkegaard calls unhappy admiration, takes hold. You may not see it, but you will feel it someday, unless, that is, you learn strategies of deflection, little sacrifices to the gods of success. Either dampen your brilliance occasionally, purposefully revealing a defect, weakness, or anxiety, or attributing your success to luck, or simply find yourself new friends. Never underestimate the power of envy. Keys to power. There are several strategies for dealing with the insidious, destructive emotion of envy. First, accept the fact that there will be people who will surpass you in some way, and also the fact that you may envy them. But make that feeling a way of pushing yourself to equal or surpass them someday. Let envy turn inward, and it poisons the soul. Expel it outward, and it can move you to greater heights. Second, understand that as you gain power, those below you will feel envious of you. They may not show it, but it is inevitable. Do not naively accept the facade they show you. Read between the lines of their criticisms, their little sarcastic remarks, the signs of backstabbing, the excessive praise that is preparing you for a fall, the resentful look in the eye. Half the problem with envy comes when we do not recognize it until it is too late. Finally, expect that when people envy you, they will work against you insidiously. They will put obstacles in your path that you will not foresee, or that you cannot trace to their source. It is hard to defend yourself against this kind of attack, and by the time you realize that envy is at the root of a person's feelings about you, it is often too late. Your excuses, your false humility, your defensive actions only exacerbate the problem. Since it is far easier to avoid creating envy in the first place than to get rid of it once it is there, you should strategize to forestall it before it grows. It is often your own actions that stir up envy, your own unawareness. By becoming conscious of those actions and qualities that create envy, you can take the teeth out of it before it nibbles you to death. Kierkegaard believed that there are types of people who create envy and are as guilty when it arises as those who feel it. The most obvious type we all know. The moment something good happens to them, whether by luck or design, they crow about it. In fact, they get pleasure out of making people feel inferior. This type is obvious and beyond hope. There are others, however, who stir up envy in more subtle and unconscious ways, and are partly to blame for their troubles. Envy is often a problem, for example, for people with great natural talent. Money others can attain, power as well, but superior intelligence, good looks, charm, these are qualities no one can acquire. The naturally perfect have to work the most to disguise their brilliance, displaying a defect or two to deflect envy before it takes root. It is a common and naive mistake to think you are charming people with your natural talents when, in fact, they are coming to hate you. A great danger in the realm of power is the sudden improvement in fortune, an unexpected promotion, a victory or success that seems to come out of nowhere. This is sure to stir up envy among your former peers. Subtly emphasize how lucky you have been to make your happiness seem more attainable to other people, and the need for envy less acute. But be careful not to affect a false modesty that people can easily see through. This will only make them more envious. The act has to be good. Your humility and your openness to those you have left behind have to seem genuine. Any hint of insincerity will only make your new status more oppressive. Remember, despite your elevated position, it will do you no good to alienate your former peers. Power requires a wide and solid support base, which envy can silently destroy. According to the Elizabethan statesman and writer Sir Francis Bacon, the wisest policy of the powerful is to create a kind of pity for themselves, as if their responsibilities were a burden and a sacrifice. How can one envy a man who has taken on a heavy load for the public interest? Disguise your power as a kind of self-sacrifice rather than a source of happiness, and you make it seem less enviable. Emphasize your troubles, and you turn a potential danger, envy, into a source of moral support, pity. A similar ploy is to hint that your good fortune will benefit those around you. To do this, you may need to open your purse strings. To deflect envy, Gracian recommends that the powerful display a weakness, a minor social indiscretion, a harmless vice. Give those who envy you something to feed on, distracting them from your more important sins. Remember, it is the reality that matters. You may have to play games with appearances, but in the end, you will have what counts, true power. In some Arab countries, a man will avoid arousing envy by showing his wealth only on the inside of his house. Apply this wisdom to your own character. Beware of some of envy's disguises. Excessive praise is an almost sure sign that the person praising you envies you. They are either setting you up for a fall, it will be impossible for you to live up to their praise, or they are sharpening their blades behind your back. At the same time, those who are hypercritical of you or who slander you publicly probably envy you as well. Recognize their behavior as disguised envy, and you keep out of the trap of mutual mudslinging or of taking their criticisms to heart. Win your revenge by ignoring their measly presence. Do not try to help or do favors for those who envy you. They will think you are condescending to them. Joe Wharton's attempt to help Hallowell find a gallery for his work only intensified his lover's feelings of inferiority and envy. Once envy reveals itself for what it is, the only solution is often to flee the presence of the enviers, leaving them to stew in a hell of their own creation.